The book of Daniel begins around the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash, first Beis HaMikdash, was destroyed in the year 3338 from creation, which was 2,443 years ago, now in the year 5781. After the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the Jews were taken from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. And that time period of time that they spent is known as Galus Bavel, the exile of Bavel, where we were taken, exiled from Israel to Bavel. Galus Bavel took 70 years before we returned to Eretz Yisrael and built the second Beis HaMikdash. And so before Galus Bavel, we had the first Beis HaMikdash. After Galus Bavel, we had the second Beis HaMikdash. And in between the first and second Beis HaMikdash, that is Galus Bavel. The first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. That's, you know, what he's most famous for. He was the first emperor of the Babylonian Empire. He was a soldier in the army of Sanherib, the emperor of Assyria, and he rebelled against the Assyrian Empire and started his own empire, which was the world superpower in its time, the Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. But before he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, there was a lot of politics and war between the Babylonian Empire and Eretz Yisrael. You know, there were many Jews in Israel who favored, you know, basically giving in, surrendering to the Babylonians and just meeting their demands. They demanded incredibly high taxes, but many Jews felt that it's better to pay the high Babylonian taxes than to, you know, than to fight and lose and be slaughtered. And, you know, other Jews felt the opposite. They felt there were a number of small countries that were trying to unite to oppose the Babylonian Empire, and they felt that even it was worth, you know, fighting to avoid, you know, these taxes and to avoid subjugation, to fight for their, you know, independence. And that was, you know, a big conflict amongst the nobles and important people in Eretz Yisrael in the years leading up to the Korban, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, in the years leading up to Galus Bavel. And the Jewish people sometimes were ruled by kings who basically pursued a policy of pacification. You know, basically they said whatever the Babylonians demand, high taxes, whatever else, we'll give it to them. That's better than fighting. And this was actually the policy that was advocated by Yirmiyahu Hanavi. He told the kings of Israel multiple times, do not defy the Babylonians, do not fight with them. If they make demands of you, give in to the demands. If they besiege you, surrender and open the gates and let them in. And this is indeed what happened about 19 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The king of Eretz Yisrael rebelled against the Babylonians. He refused to pay his taxes, and the Babylonian army marched on Yerushalayim. And this time Yirmiyahu HaNavi prevailed, and he told the king, you'd better open the gates and surrender and give in to whatever demands they make, because the alternative is the destruction of Yerushalayim, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and, you know, the end of organized Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael as we know it. And the king listened, and he opened the gates and surrendered. And Nebuchadnezzar took King Yechoniah captive and brought him to Bavel. And at the same time, he also took the strongest, best, brightest, handsomest, whatever, you know, all of the cream of the crop of Eretz Yisrael, he took with him to Bavel in this first, you know, galus of Yechoniah, the king of Eretz Yisrael. And at that time, you know, Nebuchadnezzar took four kids, teenagers, basically, and, you know, together with all the other important, powerful people. And he was looking for four things. He was looking for people who were smart, people who were strong, people who were handsome, and people who came from the royal family. And Daniel had all four of those characteristics. And that is why Nebuchadnezzar kidnapped him and his friends from Yerushalayim and brought them to Bavel. Now, why did Nebuchadnezzar want to take these people to Babel? Because he wanted them to work for him. He wanted them to be trained to be officials in the Babylonian government. And so Nebuchadnezzar put Daniel into like a special elite school, the Harvard of Babel, you know, if you will. And he wanted him to learn the language, you know, of Babel, how to speak or write in the Babylonian language, so that eventually he would be able to work for the Babylonian government. And that was more or less what these people were being trained for. Now, the thing is that Nebuchadnezzar had very strict rules and expectations of the students in this school. And one of the expectations was that they would basically remain healthy and strong, and to do that, he required them to eat everything that they were served. The problem is that the meals were not kosher. So what did Daniel do and his friends when they were faced with this rule that they had to eat the non-kosher food? So Daniel approached the cook and he said to him, please make an exception for us. But the cook was scared to help Daniel, because if Daniel ended up being less strong than the other students, then there might be an investigation. And if Nebuchadnezzar investigated and discovered that the cook was not forcing Daniel to eat everything he was served, then the cook would suffer. Nebuchadnezzar was very cruel and had a quick temper, and he did not want to antagonize, the cook did not want to antagonize the king. And so Daniel approached, you know, the waiter and made him the same offer. He said, please just let us have a vegetarian diet, just, you know, seeds, you know, vegetables, no meat, nothing non-kosher, not non-kosher bread, not non-kosher wine, just, you know, vegetables and water. And he said to the waiter, I bet you that, that if you let us eat this diet, for 10 days, we're going to be just as strong and just as healthy as everybody else in the school. And the waiter agreed, and he basically let them have this diet purely of vegetables and water. And of course, after 10 days, Daniel was not only as healthy and strong as other students, but he was more strong and more healthy than those students. And you know, eventually Daniel graduated and got a job in Nebuchadnezzar's government. Now, while Daniel was working for Nebuchadnezzar, had a dream. He forgot what the dream was, but he was very, very distressed by the dream. And so he called all of the wizards and witches and sorcerers and necromancers and fortune tellers and diviners in Babel. And he said to them, tell me what I dreamed. He didn't ask to explain the dream. He didn't remember the dream. He said, tell me what I dreamed. And they said, it's impossible. Nobody can tell a person what he dreamed. We can explain dreams, but we can't tell you what they were. And so Nebuchadnezzar basically said, off with your heads. How dare you that you're not listening to the royal command, and you'll all be executed. Daniel, when you know he heard about this, in fact, he wasn't even called, but he was going to be executed. And on his way to the gallows, he's like, why are you executing us? And he was told about the dream. And he said to the executioner, give me 3 days, I might be able to help the king. And he went with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And together they davened to Hashem for 3 days, begging Hashem to spare them and reveal to them what Nebuchadnezzar dreamed, so that way they would not be executed. And of course, Hashem answered their tefillos, and he revealed the dream to Nebuchadnezzar, to Daniel. Daniel went and told Nebuchadnezzar what he dreamed and what it meant, thereby he saved not only himself, but also all of the sorcerers of Babel. This was actually a fulfillment of the bracha that Hashem gave to Avraham Avinu, v'nivrichu v'cha, kol mishpichos ha'adama uvizarecha, that all the families of the earth will be blessed through you and through your children. And we find many, many times that descendants of Avraham Avinu, that Jewish people, save not only themselves, but also all of the Goyim who are their neighbors and who are around them. Yosef did that in the time of the famine in Egypt. Right? Millions and millions of people would have died if not for the system that he had right, of saving the food from the years of plenty. And Daniel, in a very similar manner, also saved the sorcerers of Babel from execution by his tefillos and by revealing the dream to Nebuchadnezzar. Now, when he finally comes to Nebuchadnezzar, also very similar to Yosef, when Paro says to Yosef, I hear you're an expert at interpreting dreams, Yosef says, Bil Adai Elokim Ya'aneh Shlom Paro, right, it's from Hashem. I don't understand anything, but Hashem sometimes, you know, gives me inspiration to figure out what the dream was. And Daniel said the same exact thing. It's not me who interprets dreams. Hashem is the one, who helped me, reveal to me what was in your dream. Now, in the dream, there was a statue that had five parts. It had a gold head, a silver chest, bronze stomach, iron legs, and feet that were made of a mixture of iron and clay. And in the dream, there was a stone, and the stone detached itself from the mountain. There was nobody who actually carved it out of the mountain. It just kind of detached, all by itself, and it destroyed the statue, and then it turned into a huge mountain and filled the earth. And Daniel explains to Nebuchadnezzar what exactly is the meaning of the statue and the meaning of the stone. He says the head of the statue, the gold head, represents Nebuchadnezzar. The chest, the stomach, and the legs represent empires that will come after Nebuchadnezzar. And the feet that were made out of iron and clay symbolize the last empire, the one that's going to be right before Mashiach comes. And the idea that it had feet that were made partly of iron and partly of clay tells us something about the nature and how that empire, the last one before Mashiach, would be different from all of the empires that came before it. The first point is that it's going to be a divided empire. Just like half of the feet are iron and half of it are clay, this empire will be split, I don't know between what, Democrats and Republicans, or maybe something else, but it's going to be divided. It's not going to be one power, right, that's all, of the same mind, but there's going to be two very different systems that are both, together in control of that empire. The second point is that unlike previous empires in world history, where there was constantly fighting and whoever was stronger would always take the power and nobody who was weak ever have power, always the strongest empire was in charge. This is going to be a system where the strong people will voluntarily give some of their power to the weak people. Very similar to the iron, which is strong, and the clay, which is weak. It's going to be the first empire in world history where the strong people volunteer to share their power with those who are weaker than them. Maybe in the sense, like majority versus minority, more populous states versus less populous states, more prosperous states versus less prosperous states. There's going to be this sharing of power where the strong people will voluntarily give up power so that the weak people can also have a voice in government. And finally, the last thing that the iron and clay feet symbolize, Daniel says, this is all in the Psukim, is that this last empire will try hard to unite, but it won't fully succeed. In other words, the feet are made out of clay and iron, and they work, but clay and iron just don't mix. And so there's going to still remain the distinctions between strong and weak, even though they're sharing and they're trying to be united, but it's not going to be fully successful. Now, the stone also symbolizes three things. Number one, the fact that there's no human that cut the stone. It just kind of cut by itself out of the mountain. That basically means that Mashiach is not going to be beholden, dependent, submissive to any human power. Right? It's not like, sometimes you have politicians and they owe allegiance to political bosses. Sometimes you even have presidents, and the presidents need to pay back those people who helped them get elected. The same thing when it comes, to kings, they all have people that they need to be on the good side of in order to stay in power. Mashiach will have no human that he needs to stay on their good side in order to stay in power. He'll only need to stay on Hashem's good side. That is it. Number two, this stone destroys a statue. It means that Mashiach's kingdom will replace all of the evil empires that, rule the world over the course of human history. And then the stone spreads and becomes a mountain that fills up the whole world. That basically indicates that that Mashiach's kingdom will cover the entire world. There won't be any place left in the world that it does not benefit from Mashiach's, you know, administration of the world and prosperity and enlightenment that Mashiach will bring. The lesson of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, particularly for the Jews in Galus, right, is that very often it's very depressing to look around and see the corruption and the violence and all sorts of things, you know, that are going on. And we wonder, this has been going on for so many hundreds or thousands of years, and like, will it ever end? And this was like a message to the emperor of the most powerful kingdom on earth, basically saying, yes, your empire will end. And all empires that are like yours will end, because Hashem will remember the Jewish people and bring Mashiach. And this was a very, very big consolation to the Jews in Galus Bavel, who thought that they had been abandoned. And now the king, right, the powerful, most mighty person in the world, and he's having a dream that's a reminder to him and to them that all of these evil empires will crumble, and, you know, Mashiach will come. Hashem will redeem the Jews and bring them back and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Nebuchadnezzar, interestingly enough, he wasn't mad to get this news, but he was actually happy. Now he had clarity about what the dream was and what it meant, and so he promoted Daniel to be very, very high in the government, the governor of, you know, all of Babel, and the chief of all of the wise men of Babel. The next parak talks about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and the challenge that they faced as well. Daniel was abroad on government business, and Nebuchadnezzar built a statue that was 60 amos tall. That's 120 feet, about 12 stories, 6 amos wide. It was a statue of himself, according to the Gemara, not an idol, simply a statue of himself. And when the statue was completed, Nebuchadnezzar commanded his subjects, bow down to the statue to show that you respect me and that you respect my government. And anyone who refuses to bow to the statue will be thrown into a fiery furnace. Now, interesting, there's a halachic discussion. What's the proper approach to this? It's a statue, and you're being asked to bow down to a statue, but it's not an idol. What are you supposed to do? And practically, Nebuchadnezzar's Jewish subjects, as well as all of his non-Jewish subjects, they all bowed down to the statue. And there were only three people who refused and defied the king's command. And that was Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And again, we talked about the opinion of the Rambam that says that, you know, for regular people, perhaps, this is not, you know, one of the three things that you have to give up your life for. It's not idol worship, because it's not a statue that was meant to be worshipped. It was simply a statue of the king. Bowing down wasn't an act of worship, but rather was an, you know, a demonstration of respect to the government. But at the same time, it didn't look good. It looked like idol worship, even though it wasn't. And that's the type of thing that you don't, you know, give up your life for, unless you've got a lot of followers on Facebook, unless you make a huge Kiddush Hashem by making a protest. And so the regular Jews, you know, they bow down because they didn't have so many followers. And so by their, you know, showing that they stood up for their beliefs, it was going to make a small Kiddush Hashem and not a big one. But Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they were important people. Many, many people were watching what they did. And they understood that for them, the potential for Kiddush Hashem was very, very great. And therefore, they decided to give up their lives rather than do something that looked like bowing down to an idol. So they did not bow down. Nebuchadnezzar throws them into the fiery furnace. But then he sees in the furnace, he sees Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And they're walking around there, apparently not being harmed by the fire. And there is something that looks very heavenly, spiritual, like an angel in the furnace with them. And of course, they come out of the furnace and they're alive, and even their clothing is not, you know, burned at all. This was a tremendous, tremendous Kiddush Hashem. Nebuchadnezzar proclaims all throughout his empire that everybody has to respect the God of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Everyone has to show respect for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, who rescued Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from the fiery furnace with an open miracle. The next parak deals with another dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, where he saw a tree, and a malach came and decreed, chop this tree down to its roots. And then the Malach went on and said, this tree is going to lose its mind. It's going to run out of its home and not want to live indoors, and it's going to eat grass like the cows. And the purpose, you know, to do that is to remind everybody that kings are not kings because they are brilliant or strong or popular or anything like that. But a person is a king because Hashem made him a king, and Hashem can take any person in the world and make them a king. And so Daniel was summoned to interpret the dream for Nebuchadnezzar. And he said to Nebuchadnezzar, he said, I hope that, you know, this dream is about your enemies and not about you. But basically, the tree is you, Nebuchadnezzar. And, you know, when the tree gets chopped down, that basically means that you're going to lose your mind. You'll go insane, and you'll go, you know, to live with the animals. You'll eat grass with the cows. You'll sleep, you know, on the grassy fields without a roof over your head. But the fact that the roots and the stump of the tree stays in the ground, it means that you're going to get your kingdom back after seven seasons. And, you know, the message here is that that even a madman can become the king. And if you remember that, you know, you'll be saved from Gaiva. Daniel did offer Nebuchadnezzar some advice. He says, if you want to delay or perhaps, you know, totally, you know, cancel the decree in this dream, you should give a lot of tzedakah. And indeed, for 12 months, Nebuchadnezzar gave a lot of tzedakah, and this did not happen to him. After the 12 months, he stopped. And then, indeed, he did lose his mind for seven seasons and go live with the animals. One run wild, his fingernails grew like, you know, claws, and his hair, you know, just kept on. He was literally like a madman for those seven seasons. We talked a little bit about, you know, what lessons this has, you know, for us. Gaiva is the midah of gaiva, means arrogance, or being very proud of yourself. And we pointed out that most people don't understand really what gaiva is. Most people think that if you say, I'm smart, you're a baal gaiva. I'm strong, you're a baal gaiva. It's not really true. A person can say, I'm smart and still be humble. A person can say, I'm strong and still be humble. A person can say, I'm popular and still be humble. The essence of gaiva is to think that your strongness is purely because of your own effort. You don't owe anyone for your strongness, that you don't owe anyone for your popularity, that you don't owe anyone from your brilliance. It's all because of your own hard work, and you take all the credit for your accomplishments and don't share that credit with anybody. That is gaiva. A person who's humble is a person who says, I'm smart, but that's only because Hashem made me smart. If Hashem had not made me smart, then I'd be dumb. I'm strong, but that's only because Hashem made me strong. He gave me a good body. He gave me the discipline to exercise properly. If Hashem hadn't given me the discipline, I'd be a weakling like everybody else. And I'm popular, right? It's not because, you know, I, you know, figured out, you know, the keys to win, you know, friends, right, and influence people. I'm popular because Hashem granted me a certain measure of, you know, of chen and popularity and favor in people's eyes. And a person can be humble even if they acknowledge that they're smart and strong and popular and powerful, right? And you know, and well respected, and, you know, and anything else, as long as they you know, give credit where credit is due, and they acknowledge that, you know, Hashem gave them what they needed in order to achieve what they achieved. And if Hashem had withheld you know, those, you know, things that they needed from them, then they wouldn't be any better or bigger than anybody else. We talked about how, you know, the more successful, the more powerful, the more strong, the more well-respected you are, the more that the Yetzirah tries to get you to say, I don't owe anyone, it's all because of me. And so a king who's in charge of everybody perhaps is the most at risk for gaiva. And so the Torah tells us that the king has to write two Sefer Torahs, one he keeps in shul and one he keeps with him at all times. And the reason that he writes that second Sefer Torah and keeps it with him at all times is to remind him that his kingship, he's the king from Hashem, not because he's so smart or so strong or so popular. It's because Hashem made him king. That's what the words mean, Livilti rum levavo me'achav, that his heart should not feel higher than that of his brothers. And that's why he keeps the Sefer Torah with him at all times, to remind him that he is no better than the rest of the Jews who are not kings. And this basically is the idea of the golden mean, which means that if you're at risk for a particular yetzer hara, so you need to balance it out. And so a person who's at risk, let's say for eating too much, you know, so maybe for a little bit of time, they should eat very, very little so that they balance. And hopefully from then on, after they've, you know, spent a few days, you know, eating very little, from then on, they'll eat a balanced amount. A person who spends too much money, right, maybe they should, you know, take all the credit cards out of their wallet and only put a certain amount of cash in every morning. And that way they're going to be balanced. They have something that sort of counterbalances the yetzer hara for spending too much money. A person, let's say, who is very, very angry, gets angry very easily, right, needs to be like, you know, have some sort of a something to balance them, to keep them calm, whether it's like a stress, you know, ball, or whether it's just repeating over and over in their head, right, I must not get angry, I must not get angry. Whatever it is, we need something to balance out our yetzer haras. And so the king's mini sefer Torah, right, he's got a strong yetzer Hara to be a Baal Gaiva, and the Yetzer Hara is meant, the Sefer Torah is meant to balance that out, to remind him that he should not be arrogant, and he should remember that he's only the king because Hashem chose him. Nebuchadnezzar was not a Jewish king, obviously. He didn't have that Sefer Torah, and that's why he was very much at risk of being a Baal Gaiva, of being arrogant. This dream and his memory of going, you know, insane, of losing his mind, and then still getting his kingdom back, that was meant to help him achieve the golden mean and to counterbalance the Yetzer Hara for Gaiva. The next parak of Daniel talks about Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. That was, his name was Belshazzar. He was the last ruler of Babel. And he's famous for making a party at which an angel drew on the wall, and then he was assassinated. Why did he make the party? He thought that the 70 years of Galus Babel were up, and guess what? Hashem did not bring the Jews back to Israel, so he thought the Jews will be mine forever and ever and ever, and so he made a party to celebrate that. But at the party, he commanded that the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash should be brought out of his, of his, you know, treasury, because he thought that Hashem doesn't care about them anymore. He didn't redeem the Jews, even though 70 years were up. He brought out the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, and he served wine to all of his guests. And together, the guests basically praised their idols because they thought that their idols were victorious over Hashem. And as they were doing that and praising their idols, a hand came out of the wall, right in one of the lightest parts of the hall where everybody could see it. And the hand wrote something on the wall. But people didn't know what it wrote. They could not read what it had written. Belshazzar was terrified. His legs started to shake. And he was very, very scared. And, you know, of course, his wife, you know, suggested, you know, maybe summon Daniel. He's very smart. You know, he's explained things that were mysterious before. Maybe he can explain this as well. And the words that the hand wrote on the wall were the words, Mine, Mine, Takel Ufarsin. And they were written in an alphabet which most Jews had forgotten at the time, even though, you know, now everybody knows that alphabet. It's the alphabet that the Sefer Torahs are written in. But back then, you know, many people suggested Jews had forgotten it, or else there was some other reason that the other Jews, you know, were unable to read it. Maybe it was written, you know, from top to bottom instead of from right to left, or something along those lines. But no one else could understand what the words were until Daniel came. And Daniel explained that the words Mene Mene means counted, counted. In other words, that you know, Hashem has counted the days of your kingdom, and that's it. You've used up all of the days. Takel means weighed. In other words, that your merits and sins have been weighed, and the sins are too heavy. And therefore, Ufarsin, Ufarsin means divided. Your kingdom will be divided between the kingdom of Paras and the kingdom of Madai. And that's exactly what happened. That night, Belshazzar was assassinated, and Daryavesh, the king of Madai, took over his empire. Daryavesh is famous, as I said, for defeating Belshazzar and taking over the Babylonian Empire, as well as for giving permission to the Jews to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. And Daryavesh, he allowed many officials from the Babylonian Empire to keep their jobs in his empire. And Daniel was one of those officials. And in fact, Daniel came to his attention because he did his job really well, and he was really honest, and he was hardworking. He wasn't lazy. And when Daryavesh saw that Daniel was an especially, you know, spiritual or person who, you know, was a spirited person, you know, he was considering appointing Daniil, firing, you know, many of his other top-level officials and just making Daniil into his viceroy. Now, those other officials who were going to get fired were, they did not like Daniil because they saw him as a threat to their job. And so they, you know, they tried to first find some sort of a scandal, but Daniil was literally clean. There was no scandal at all. He was totally honest, totally hardworking. He had never messed up anything. And so they could not create a scandal. They could not find any scandal. So they decided they had to create one. And they knew that the best way to create a scandal around a Jewish person had something to do with Judaism and halacha. So they went to the king and they suggested to the king and they said, hey, we've got a great suggestion for you. Why don't you make a law to test out the loyalty of all of the people from these countries that you conquered? You know, because you don't want people who are not loyal to you to have power in your government. And the king was all ears because, you know, no king wants to have disloyal people in the government. And so they said, this is what the law should be, that that everybody needs to acknowledge. Everybody needs to say when they want something, they can't ask their parent or their rabbi or their boss for that. The request has to be always directed to King Daryavish. King Daryavish, can you get me some breakfast cereal? King Daryavish, where can I find this reference? King Daryavish, you know, can we have extra recess? You can't direct requests to anybody other than King Daryavish, and that would show that no one has permission to do anything in the empire unless King Daryavish gives them permission. Your teacher doesn't have permission to answer your question. The principal doesn't have permission to give you extra recess. Your mom doesn't have permission to give you breakfast if King Daryavish decides otherwise. And so by saying King Daryavish instead of mom or King Daryavish instead of rabbi, you're basically acknowledging that King Daryavish is the ultimate authority in the empire. And they said, oh, you can't either ask any god for anything. All requests have to be directed to King Daryavish. Because it's disloyal to suggest that God is in charge of the king. And that was basically the law that the officials convinced Daryavish to make. The penalty for disobeying the law is to get thrown into a lion's den. And of course, Daniel was not going to keep this law. He continued to daven to Hashem, Shachris, Mincha, and Ma'ariv the way that he always did. And of course, you know, the ministers whose jobs were in danger, they, you know, they spied on Daniel and they found him davening and they had him arrested and they brought him to Daryavish and they're like, you know, this man disobeyed your law. And Daryavish was very distressed because he liked Daniel a lot and he did not want to lose Daniel. He did not want to have to execute him. We pointed out that there's another reason why he was distressed as well, which is that he realized that these ministers did not actually have his best interests in mind when they convinced him to make the law. It wasn't really a law to make sure that only loyal people stayed in the government. It was really that they were twisting him around their little finger. They were manipulating him in order to get rid of somebody whom they perceived as a threat and a rival. And that's never, you know, pleasant for a king to realize that he's being manipulated. But he was mainly distressed because he liked Daniel a lot and he did not want to lose him. He summoned all of his, you know, attorneys and demanded that they find a loophole in the law that would let him avoid executing Daniel. But even though the attorneys worked, you know, all day long, they could not find any loophole. Maybe they were in cahoots with those people whose jobs, you know, were threatened. And so basically he had no choice at evening time but to throw Daniel into the lion's pit. He throws Daniel into the lion's den and he seals the door with his signet ring with wax so that nobody can open it. It's going to be tamper proof. If anybody opens that door, you know, it would be clearly visible that the seal would be broken. And, you know, some Mefarshim explain that Daryavish did this because he didn't want Daniel to get lynched. Like very often, you know, in the south of the United States years ago, somebody would be arrested and then, you know, the Ku Klux Klan would break into jail and execute them before they, you know, and basically lynch them, hang them before they had a, you know, chance to have a trial by jury and prove their innocence. And Daryavish was nervous. He said that Daniel is a big tzaddik and he doesn't deserve to die. The lions won't harm him. But his enemies, his human enemies, who have free will, they have the ability to harm even somebody even somebody who doesn't deserve to die. And so he doesn't need to be protected from the lions, but he does need to be protected from his fellow humans. This is, by the way, another parallel between Daniel and Yosef, that Reuven felt it's better for Yosef to be in the pit with the snakes and scorpions than it is to be at the mercy of his brothers, because the snakes and scorpions will not kill a tzaddik. Whereas humans who are mad and jealous and upset could kill even someone who doesn't deserve to die. So he seals the pit so that no one can come in and lynch Daniel overnight. Daryavish did a lot of things to show how much he liked Daniel, you know, starting from being distressed when he learned that Daniel was going to be executed, to convening the attorneys to find a loophole in the law, to sealing the pit so that nobody can lynch Daniel, while he's there. Some more things that Daryavish, does is like he literally like isn't hungry, he has no appetite for dinner. Once he throws Daniel into the lion's den, he skips the after dinner entertainment. He's so upset and nervous that he can't sleep all night long. And so as soon as the sun rises, he gets up, even though he usually doesn't get up until the third hour of the day, and he goes straight to the lion's pit and he says, "Daniel, are you still alive?" And Daniel is still alive. The lions did not hurt him. That's a tremendous miracle that happened to Daniel. And that more or less. And then, of course, Daryavish throws all of the ministers who manipulated him into the lion's den, because now he's not content just to fire them, but he just wants them out of the way so that they're no threat to him at all, and to punish them for conspiring against Daniel. So this is more or less the narrative portions of Sefer Daniel. Again, just by way of review, Daniel was famous for many, many things. He was, smart, strong, handsome, from the royal family. He was kidnapped by Nebuchadnezzar, put into the Harvard of Babylonia. He refused to eat treif, but yet he was still stronger and smarter than all the other students. He was appointed to the government. He interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. He gave Nebuchadnezzar advice. And then later on, he interpreted the handwriting on the wall for Belshazzar. He refused to stop davening for Daryavish's decree. He was thrown in a lion's den and survived. And that's, a number of things that Daniel is famous for. We pointed out that, Daniel, there's a machlokas in Midrashim about what happened to Daniel. According to some Midrashim, he retired peacefully and made aliyah to Israel when the second Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt. According to others, he was murdered by Haman at some point before Haman himself was hung in Megillas Esther. Those are two opinions about what happens to Daniel. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are famous. Also, they were, smart, strong, handsome, of royal descent. They were also kidnapped from Yerushalayim and put into the Harvard of Bavel. They too, with Daniel, refused to eat treif, and yet they were smarter and stronger than the other students, in the school. When Daniel needed to interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dreams, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah joined him in davening to Hashem for siyata dishmaya and divine assistance in explaining and knowing what the dreams were. And of course, they were also famous when Daniel was away on a state, trip, that, they were the ones who refused to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's statue and were thrown into the fiery furnace and survived. Just one last point that we mentioned is that there is a tradition that in the fiery furnace, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah each composed a prayer that begins with the word Rachum and ends with the word Rachum, and those prayers are gathered together, and we say them every Monday and Thursday in Tachnon, Vuhu Rachum, Yichaper Avon, V'lo Yashchis, Yerval Hashiva Po, etc. That prayer was composed jointly by Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, according to many traditions, and so we still have this, memory, in terms of, their contribution to prayer, in addition to the stories about their, heroic personalities and their mesiras nefesh, their self-sacrifice, for the sake of Kiddush Hashem, is something just, to remember, as we daven, every Monday and Thursday, that, these prayers were composed by Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah.